Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is an Aftershock Monday episode, and today I'm going to be taking a really close look at Shadow Doctor number one. It's from writer Peter Calloway. The art is by Georges Jante. Colors are by Juan Cho, and letters and back matter design are by Charles Pritchett. Now, what's really interesting, I should say, about Shadow Doctor is it is based on a true story, the real life story of writer Peter Calloway's grandfather. So it makes for a very, very compelling read, maybe more so than, you know, another book of this caliber that sort of draws on historical events, but is not, you know, true to life or didn't actually happen to somebody. The fact that this story, the events in the story actually happened to somebody, is what helps to make it so compelling. And that's not to say that it's the violence is glorified or you know, the criminal enterprise is glorified. And Peter Calloway even talks in the back of the book about how some of these things that his grandfather did, you know, they're not necessarily things to be proud of, but they are, you know, real events. So it starts off on the first page. It says, "This is a true story," and it talks about the fact that there's a saying among the Cherokee people, the Native Americans, and this boy learned it when he was 8 years old, when he was kidnapped by his mother and taken to live on a reservation in Oklahoma. And the saying is, the infant is unaware it has been eaten by the wolf. So sometimes you're just not aware. You don't have enough experience in life to understand the things that are happening around you. And the narrator here is saying that this saying scared them as a boy. Where was the wolf that was about to eat him? Had it happened already? Did he even realize? And he says, "It's been over 60 years since the medicine man first told me that saying, but it scares me still." And as we are seeing this narration happen, what we're seeing in the images is a forest scene where there's a mouse and he's nibbling on a little something when a snake sneaks up behind him. And so it's very sort of foreshadowing that, oh, it's not a wolf that eats the infant, but maybe it's a snake that eats the mouse. But at the last moment, as the snake's about to pounce on the mouse, there are some headlights in the distance and the mouse runs off and escapes from the snake. And we see a caravan of trucks approaching. There's a man of color driving, and the person in the truck next to him is saying, you know, the forest and the city, they're not so different. If you just look at it quickly, it all seems calm and peaceful. But when you look at it really closely, you see all the creatures, you see all the other things that are kind of beneath the surface. They're trying to get a nut, he says, or two before winter sets in. And maybe they might be a little bit lucky and they'll get a nut as well. So all of a sudden, as they're driving through, this guy's talking to the driver saying, you know, scheming and fights for territory, for the best ground. It's there to take. And if there's a law of the wild, it's no matter who you are, you got to eat. And you know what? I love the forest. And as he's saying that, all of a sudden, they realize there's a log in the road. And the guy who's driving the first truck, the man of color, has to slam on his brakes and come to a halt. And the guy who's in the car with him is like, hey, dude, you got to be careful, you know, the whiskey. And the guy driving, Nathaniel, says, well, I know, but it came out of nowhere. And as the guy in the passenger seat gets out, his second in command saying, is everything all right, boss? And the man who's in charge, who will come to learn, is actually Al Capone. He says, yeah, it's just a fallen tree. Get everybody backed up. We got to go around. And the young man who's driving the truck, the young man of color, he's not sure. He senses something's off, it looks like. And the guy who just a few minutes ago was talking about how much he loves the forest now is saying how much he hates it. Meanwhile, the driver of the truck, the young man, the young black man, has gotten out and he's looking at the tree. And Al Capone's like, what are you doing? Let's go. He said, the young driver of the truck says, well, it looks like it was cut down, which that is a whole different story, right? Like if a tree falls and blocks off a road you happen to be driving on while you're bootlegging whiskey, that's one thing. But the fact that it looks like it was cut down, that's an entirely different situation. Obviously, it's a good thing that this young man, Nathaniel, went over and took a look. And so with that little bit of warning, they realize that it's an ambush and they're all able to get to cover before all of a sudden, whoever these maybe it's a rival gang, maybe it's law enforcement, we don't know at this point, they all start shooting. So all of a sudden there's a firefight going on, and we see some guys come out of the trees. And yes, sure enough, it does look like it's a rival gang. Nathaniel, the young black driver of the truck, hides underneath the truck. He doesn't have a weapon, while Al Capone and his goons sort of fight off the ambush by the Irish. So it's the Irish mafia against the Italian mafia here that we're trying to steal the bootleg whiskey of Al Capone and his cohorts. And meanwhile, Nathaniel, like I said, he doesn't have a weapon, so he's just taking cover underneath the truck, holding his hands to his head, covering his ears, trying to drown out the sound of all the gunfire. And he's thinking that he knows it's got to be the Irish because nobody else would dare to ambush Al Capone. And the only thing more terrifying than the chaos was the silence that followed, right? Like, does that mean that his side has won, his side has lost? Like, what happens next? And he thinks about that time in his life he ever believed in God, but that night he prayed. He prayed that the Italians had won because he knows that his life depended on it. And sure enough, Al Capone's second in command walks over and kind of bends down and looks under the truck. And he's like, and he says, you need me to grab you some leaves so you can wipe Nat. Obviously the insinuation there being that Nat was so scared that he pooped his pants. So, the scene then shifts on the next page and we see that, Nat is in the hospital, but he's much, much older. He's a much older man. Maybe on his deathbed here, and he's relaying the story to somebody, and he's talking about the night in the fall of 1923 where everything changed for him. And the next morning he went down to the docks and he wrote two letters. The first was to his father, whom he hadn't written to since he put Nat on a train to Chicago 6 months before, and the second was to himself. He wrote a letter to himself making a promise that he would do something with his life. And those two letters are the reason that Nat eventually became a doctor. And as the scene shifts from us looking at Nat, we see that there's somebody sitting in the chair next to him who says, Dad, is that true? So this must be Peter Calloway's father, Nat being the grandfather. And Nat says, yeah, it's true that I wrote two letters, of course. And his son says, no, about running the whiskey and being ambushed by the Irish. And Nat says, yeah, it's true as those bullets in the gun. His son says, I can't believe I didn't know any of this. How could you not have told me this story? And Nat says, well, I never told anybody. And his son's like, well, why not? And Nat says, well, because until now, I wasn't dying, at least not more than anybody else. And his son's like, oh my God, you don't know that you're dying. And Nat replies, well, yes, I'm a doctor, David. I actually do know that I'm dying. And those men, you know, they're not the kind, well, you know what, let me put it this way. I've lived long enough to know that I'm dying of cancer because I've always known with men like that, memories are long and tempers are short. And so his son says, well, is that why you never told me the story? You were worried that me having the knowledge of that bootlegging operation that you were a part of would put me in danger. And Nat says, no, David, that story is insignificant. But this isn't a story about running whiskey. And David says, well, then what is a story about? And Nat says, well, it's about the choice that I made 8 years later. And so the story then moves forward to 1931, 8 years later. Nathaniel has gone to medical school. He's graduated and he's being interviewed in a hospital. And what's interesting is when the nurse comes out and calls his name, the nurse out in the waiting room says, well, he's not here. And the first nurse who called his name says, what do you mean? He's late. And the nurse at the desk says, no, he's on time. And the first nurse says, well, but you just said he wasn't here. And the nurse in the waiting area is like, no, I mean, he's here, but I wasn't sure what to do with him because of the hospital policy. It says he can't be in here in this waiting room. And the second nurse, with a realization, this look on her face was like, oh, wait, why can't he be in here? Well, it's because he's a Black man, right? And this is 1931. Even though he's a doctor, even though he's gone to medical school and he's graduated, he can't even be in the waiting room of the hospital because he's a Black man. So the story begins to be narrated by Nathaniel again. He's obviously relaying the story to David, and he's talking about how it took him 8 hard years of work to become a doctor. And he graduated from the University of Illinois with enough knowledge to be one. But technically, you're not truly a doctor until you have patients. And obviously, Nathaniel didn't have any. And he can't get hired either. And it's you know, that dichotomy. So the nurse does go out to the hallway. She gets him. She brings him in for his interview. And the man behind the desk is saying, you know, if you got through Dean Michaels Medical School with high marks, that in and of itself makes you qualified to work at this hospital. And Nathaniel's like, he's, you know, very proud of himself, obviously, for this accomplishment, and says, oh, well, thank you, sir. And the man behind the desk says, well, don't thank me yet, because there's no way I can hire you. And Nathaniel's like, well, wait a second. You just told me high marks, and how could that not make me qualified? You know, I don't understand. Did Thomas not tell you? And so apparently Dean Thomas, probably meaning, you know, well-meaning, didn't tell this guy, the person that's in charge of the hospital, in charge of the hiring, that Nathaniel was a Black guy. And obviously he can't even be in the waiting room. This isn't a hospital. You know, again, racism and bigotry, you know, 1931, this country, not what, 50 years since the Civil War. So, you know, a lot of work still to be done. And the man says, no, he didn't tell me. And so Nathaniel stands up and says, okay, I see. I won't waste any more of your time. And, the man behind the desk says, you know, have you tried the colored hospital down on the south side of Chicago, maybe? And Nathaniel says, well, it closed down 6 months ago because, you know, of course it did. And so, Nathaniel, again, relaying the story to his son, says, I'll never forget what he said to me as I left that room. He said, son, I hope you understand it's not personal. How could it be anything but personal? Like, I'm not a man of color. You know, I live life on the easy setting, and I'm fully aware of that, you know, being a straight white guy. But how can you tell somebody, how can you be so oblivious? And I guess it just goes to the time, right? The atmosphere, the prevailing a sentiment and feelings of society. Oh, we're persecuting you and we're prejudiced against you, but it doesn't have anything to do with you personally. It's just your race. But I mean, for an African-American man, I mean, so much of their identity is wrapped up in their culture, you know, for a lot of families. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. I applaud them for that. You know, a lot of them have a better sense of culture and togetherness and community than a lot of white communities do. And so much of who they are is wrapped up in that community and race. And so to say it's not personal, like, I mean, he obviously can't turn around and tell the guy off, but man, I can only imagine how terrible that must have been. And the fact that Peter Calloway even puts it in the book, it's probably something specifically that Nathaniel had, I mean, according to this story, I mean, we don't know, it's based on a true story, but what is actually told, but it wouldn't be surprising to know that stuck with Nathaniel for the rest of his life, and something that he specifically told his son, David, who then in turn told the grandson, Peter Calloway. It boggles the mind to say that, yeah, we're not going to hire you specifically because of the color of your skin, despite your success in medical school, despite how hard you worked, despite how the guy that does the hiring himself, hey, the fact that you got high marks in Dean Thomas's program makes you qualified to work here, but you can't work here, but it's not personal. How can you take that as anything but personal? So anyway, getting back to the story, Nathaniel is we see a series of panels where he goes to speak to other hospitals. And he says, I found out it also wasn't personal at the Citizens Bank of Chicago when without any hospitals to hire me, this bank wouldn't loan me money to start my own practice. It wasn't personal at the Bank of the Great Lakes where I tried the same thing, or the Northern Bank and Trust either. No, it wasn't personal. It wasn't personal at all. It was only the color of my skin, is what Nathaniel says. And that gets to my point, right? How can it be anything but personal? If it's not personal, then hire the guy, you know? If it's not personal, then hire the guy. It's as simple as that. Put your money where your mouth is. So anyway, he goes on to say it was 1931. It was only 2 years since the stock market crashed. You know, the Great Depression is in full swing, and people had by and large held on, but the Depression's grip on the country was tightening and people were beginning to choke. We see as Nathaniel walks through the streets of Chicago, people in line at soup kitchens and whatnot, and people walking around with signs saying, I know three trades, I have three children, I only want one job. And Nathaniel's talking about there was starvation and illness and death, the great demons of failure. They were on every doorstep, just as they were on his doorstep. You know, he's gone to medical school and he doesn't have a penny to his name. You know, this guy's talented. This guy's smart, and he can't even get a job. So he's telling his son Daniel that most decisions they're quiet things. You know, they're born of an idea. They're made in the moment. After you've had time to think, but decisions that are made out of desperation, they're not quiet things. They're like wolves, right? We go back to the idea of the wolf eating the infant. To illustrate that point, Nathaniel even says, those decisions that you make, the ones that you make out of desperation because you're backed into a corner, those decisions are like wolves. And the person that's trapped in that situation, that's the infant in front of the wolf. So it goes back to that idea of being devoured by the wolf as an infant and not even being aware that it happened. And that's how Nathaniel feels when he's backed into this corner. He has no choice, and he's helpless. He's helpless. And you can debate the morality of the decisions he makes, and we'll certainly explore it as we go along in the story. But what the hell was he supposed to do? You know, he's been rejected time and time again, but it's not personal because of the color of his skin. What choice did he have? So he's made this choice. He's going to try another tactic. He doesn't feel like there's anything else out there for them. So he goes to a specific building. There's a white doorman in front of the building. And of course, won't let him in. And Nathaniel's asking, well, why won't you let me in? And the man said, well, we have standards to uphold. And Nathaniel says, well, can I at least send a message to one of the guests? And the guy said, no, under no circumstances, just, you know, get out of here. And Nathaniel's like, why not? And the guy's like, do I need to spell it out for you? And as he's saying that, somebody comes walking out of the door and he says, is there a problem here? And the doorman says, well, yeah, as a matter of fact, there is. And the man that comes walking out is Capone's second in command. And he immediately recognizes Nat. And he says, Nat, oh my God, is that you? It is you. And he gives a big hug and, hey, it's been forever. And Nathaniel greets him and the doorman's just shocked. Well, you know this guy? You know a black man? And Maddie's like, oh, what does it look like to you? Come on up, Nat. I'm sure the boss will be happy to see you. And the doorman's like, well, hold on a second. We can't just let some N-word into the Lexington Hotel. And I mean, I don't know who this guy thinks he is, this doorman. He's got to know who Capone is and who Matt is. And Matt turns around and like, Nathaniel may be colored, but he's no N-word. He's free to enter this building anytime he wants. You understand? And, you know, maybe the doorman realizing who he's talking to. Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. Yep. I understand. And so Maddie ushers him into the building and he's like, I'm sorry about that. And Nathaniel, it's not your fault. Obviously, he understands with what he's been through recently. And Maddie's like, still so uncivilized and but I do have to frisk you before we go up, you know, I mean, it is the boss. And so Nathaniel's like, times have changed, huh? And Maddie says, well, you know, the boss, he's not so little anymore, if you catch my meaning. And Nathaniel obviously knows. I mean, he lives in Chicago in 1931. Everybody knows who Al Capone is at that time. And he even says, yeah, I knew. And this is Nathaniel again narrating. Yeah, I knew. Of course I knew. Anyone who read the newspaper knew. In those 8 years since Nathaniel had stopped driving bootleg trucks for Capone, Capone had become a household name. And so that's why Nathaniel's going to him. I mean, he's got no choice. Nathaniel's saying, yeah, to his family, he was Poppy. To his friends, he was Shorty. But the newspapers, they always called him by a different name. One that he actually never cared for, right? Scarface, which is the name a lot of people know him by. And so he heads up to the penthouse and walks in, and there's Capone to greet him, saying, hey, look who the wolves dragged in. So there's Peter Calloway again using that term. Wolves, and in a way he's 100% correct. Look who the wolves have dragged in. Well, yeah, that decision that Nathaniel had to make, because he had no other choice. He's got to provide for himself. He's got to provide for his family. And that decision made out of desperation, just like a wolf backing you into a corner, and you're the infant who doesn't even know he's been gobbled up. So great turn of phrase there by Peter Calloway to have Capone say, yeah, look, not look who the dog dragged in, or look who the cat dragged in, but look who the wolf dragged in. So really, really great job. And then for the back matter, we mentioned the letters that Nathaniel himself mentioned, the letters that he wrote, those two letters he wrote to himself right after that ambush by the Irish. And those letters directly informed him and motivated him to become a doctor. And that's the back matter that we see. He wrote one to his father. He wrote one to himself that starts off, I promise. And, you know, we get the whole thing. And the fact that Nathaniel was a black man at that time, a young black man, don't get me wrong, because he's still relatively young when he finishes up medical school. But just the fact that he was, you know, a teenager at that time and he could read and write, that was something. It shows Nathaniel was definitely a smart guy, you know, because there were plenty of blacks at that time who couldn't read or write. But anyway, for the back matter, you can see that you can read the letter that Nathaniel wrote to himself. And then there's a family album, an interview with the writer, Peter Calloway. And it does have an editor's note that says, portions of this interview originally ran in the Hollywood Reporter, How Shadow Doctor Turns a Family History into a Comic, from July of 2020. And it's basically just an interview with Peter Calloway, and it gives some background and some history about Nathaniel Calloway, Peter's grandfather. We get to see a picture of Nathaniel as a much older man, and it's great. It really sort of informs the story. It gives us an idea of the sense of history and the respect that Peter Calloway has for his grandfather, even as he knows that some of the decisions his grandfather made probably weren't the best decisions. But again, it comes through in the story that Peter Calloway has told, because, hey, man, the wolves are at the door. The times are tough. It's 1931. There's not a booming economy going on. People are struggling. People are hand to mouth. People are starving. People are sick. And he feels that he was forced to do this. Forced to make these decisions. So I do encourage you to read the interview. It's got a lot of great information as well. Last thing I'll say about the book, Georges Jeanneté, I'm not typically a big fan of Georges' work, because I feel like it's not really dynamic. But here's the thing, right? Like, I've only previously seen Georges' work in superhero comics. This is not a superhero comic. This is exactly the kind of comic that George's art style is perfectly suited for. Not to say there's no action, because there is. You know, we have the ambush from when the Italians are bootlegging the whiskey and the Irish attack them. But it is a lot of talking heads, and it is a lot of emotional weight that needs to come across in the posture of the characters, you know, the character acting in the panels, in the desperation in the faces of the children we see as Nathaniel Calloway's walking through the city, wondering, what am I going to do? I've tried every hospital. I've tried every bank. Nobody will give me a loan. Nobody will hire me. And when you see Nathaniel walk around the city and he sees those that are in desperate straits, he sees the children that are starving. And these aren't even black children. These are white children. And I'm sure Nathaniel's thinking to himself, here are whites who can't even feed themselves. And here I am, a black man. What chance do I have? And it all helps to feed the wolf, that wolf that becomes the desperate decision that he makes to go and seek out Al Capone, somebody who's become a household name as a criminal in the time that Nate used to drive for him and in the time that he has finished medical school. So in those scenes, in those panels, in the storytelling visually, from transition as we go from panel to panel, that's where the strength of Georges Jeantet's art is. It's that desperation, the cynicism, the depression in terms of everybody just being tired and worn down. All of that comes through so well in Georges Jeantet's artwork and also in the colors by Juan Cho, who gives it somewhat of a muted look, a lot of blues and grays with a little bit of orange as a contrast. And it helps to set the tone and the mood so well. And it complements the facial expressions and that body language that Georges Jeantet does such an incredible job at throughout the story. Because again, there's not a lot of superhero type action in order to build drama and in order to have characters playing off of one another. So instead, what we get are these scenes with body language, you know, that convey the emotion and the frustration that not only Nathaniel is feeling, but some of the other characters as well. And it is something so subtle, and unless you're looking for it or aware of it, you may miss it. You may not realize subconsciously how much it's informing the story. From things like Nathaniel slamming on the brakes with 2 feet when that log is across the road, or the way Nathaniel is hiding under the truck, and you can see the fear that he feels in his posture and the way he's hiding, in the way that the body language of the nurse who comes out calling his name, asking for him to come in and do his job interview, the confusion and the look on her face when she realizes, Nathaniel Calloway is a black man. That's why he's not in the waiting room. Or the deflated feeling that you get when Nathaniel gets up from his first interview, or the subsequent panels when he's going to the banks, how in each panel he's slumping down more and more as the weight of this continual rejection starts to weigh him down. All these things that aren't really overt in the way the story is told, but which Georges Jeantet does such an incredible job of conveying mood and tone because of the body language. And the last thing I'll mention about body language is when Maddie sees him outside the door, the confusion of the doorman in his posture, Maddie's excitement to see Nathaniel and give him a big hug. Here's a white guy hugging a black guy. That you don't see that every day on the street in 1931 Chicago. And so it's those little moments that show how incredible Georges Jeantet's art is in terms of suiting this story that's being told. It's just great. And as you're reading it, you may not even realize how much it's informing and giving you knowledge of these relationships. It's subtextual, you know, it's subconscious. So an incredible job, a great start to the story from Peter Calloway, wonderful, wonderful artwork from Georges Jeantet and the colors by Juan Cho. It's all done really, really well. So I do encourage you to check this out. Obviously, we're big fans of Aftershock here. We cover a lot of their books, and there's a reason for that. It's because these are comics that are worth reading. So it has my recommendation. The second issue's out. I'm going to cover that in a bonus episode today as well. So I highly, highly encourage you to check out the first couple issues. They're already out there at your local comic shop. And if you can't find it there, you can ask them to order it for you. Or, of course, you can check it out digitally. So that's going to do it for this episode, everybody. As I said, there'll be a second bonus episode today for Aftershock, where I'll go ahead and cover Shadow Doctor issue number 2. So I want to thank everybody for joining me as always, and we'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.